Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the July 1st, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read an article about how weather forecasting got good. And, to honor the 200th anniversary of Walt Whitman's birth, I'll read his poem, The Sleepers. Let's start today with Walt Whitman. Last week, I read an article about Whitman by Peter Schildahl, in which he recommends observing Whitman's 200th birthday by reading aloud what he refers to as The Miraculous Sleepers, published in 1855, in which Whitman eavesdrops on the slumber of multitudes, alive and dead, and interweaves dreams of his own. Schildahl says, "Reading Whitman silently enriches, but hearing your own or a partner's voice luxuriate in the verse's unhurried, insinuating cadences, drawn along on waves of alternately rough and delicate feeling, can quite overwhelm. That's because your voice, if you are fluent in American, is anticipated, pre-wired into the declarative, but intimate, easy-flowing lines. It's as if you were a phonograph needle dropped into a vinyl groove." And now, The Sleepers by Walt Whitman, published in 1855. 1. I wander all night in my vision, stepping with light feet, swiftly and noiselessly stepping and stopping, bending with open eyes over the shut eyes of sleepers, wandering and confused, lost to myself, ill-assorted, contradictory, pausing, gazing, bending, and stopping. How solemn they look there, stretched and still. How quiet they breathe, the little children in their cradles. The wretched features of inuits, the white features of corpses, the livid faces of drunkards, the sick gray faces of onanists, the gashed bodies on battlefields, the insane in their strong-doored rooms, the sacred idiots, the newborn emerging from gates, and the dying emerging from gates. The night pervades them and enfolds them. The married couple sleep calmly in their bed, he with his palm on the hip of the wife, and she with her palm on the hip of the husband. The sisters sleep lovingly side by side in their bed. The men sleep lovingly side by side in theirs. And the mother sleeps with her little child carefully wrapped. The blind sleep, and the deaf and the dumb sleep. The prisoner sleeps well in the prison. The runaway son sleeps. The murderer that is to be hung next day, how does he sleep? And the murdered person, how does he sleep? The female that loves unrequited sleeps. And the male that loves unrequited sleeps. The head of the moneymaker that plotted all day sleeps. And the enraged and treacherous dispositions all sleep. I stand in the dark with drooping eyes by the worst suffering and the most restless. I pass my hands soothingly to and fro a few inches from them. The restless sink in their beds. They fitfully sleep. Now I pierce the darkness. New beings appear. The earth recedes from me into the night. I saw that it was beautiful, and I see that what is not the earth is beautiful. I go from bedside to bedside. I sleep close with the other sleepers, each in turn. I dream in my dream all the dreams of the other dreamers, and I become the other dreamers. I am a dance. Play up there. The fit is whirling me fast. I am the ever-laughing. It is new moon and twilight. I see the hiding douceurs. I see nimble ghosts whichever way I look. Cache and cache again deep in the ground and sea, and where it is neither ground nor sea. Well do they do their jobs, these journeymen divine. Only from me can they hide nothing, and would not if they could. I reckon I am their boss, and they make me a pet besides, and surround me and lead me and run ahead of when I walk. To lift their cunning covers to signify me with stretched arms and resume the way. Onward we move, a gay gang of black guards, with mirth-shouting music and wild flapping pennants of joy. I am the actor, the actress, the voter, the politician, the immigrant and the exile, the criminal that stood in the box, he who has been famous and he who shall be famous after today, the stammerer, the well-formed person, the wasted or feeble person. I am she who adorned herself and folded her hair expectantly. My truant lover has come, and it is dark. Double yourself and receive me, darkness. Receive me and my lover, too. He will not let me go without him. I roll myself upon you as upon a bed. I resign myself to the dusk. He whom I call answers me and takes the place of my lover. He rises with me silently from the bed. Darkness, you are gentler than my lover. His flesh was sweaty and panting. I feel the hot moisture yet that he has left me. My hands are spread forth. I pass them in all directions. I would sound up the shadowy shore to which you are journeying. Be careful, darkness. Already what was it touched me? I thought my lover had gone, else darkness and he are one. I hear the heartbeat. I follow. I fade away. 2. I descend my western course. My sinews are flaccid. Perfume and youth course through me, and I am their wake. It is my face, yellow and wrinkled, instead of the old woman's. I sit low in a straw-bottomed chair and carefully darn my grandson's stockings. It is I, too, the sleepless widow looking out on the winter midnight. I see the sparkles of starshine on the icy and pallid earth. A shroud I see, and I am the shroud. I wrap a body and lie in the coffin. It is dark here underground. It is not evil or pain here. It is blank here. For reasons. It seems to me that everything in the light and air ought to be happy. Whoever is not in his coffin and the dark grave, let him know he has enough. 3. I see a beautiful, gigantic swimmer swimming naked through the eddies of the sea. His brown hair lies close and even to his head. He strikes out with courageous arms. He urges himself with his legs. I see his white body. I see his undaunted eyes. I hate the swift-running eddies that would dash him head foremost on the rocks. What are you doing, you ruffianly red-trickled waves? Will you kill the courageous giant? Will you kill him in the prime of his middle age? Steady and long he struggles. He is baffled, banged, bruised. He holds out while his strength holds out. The slapping eddies are spotted with his blood. They bear him away. They roll him, swing him, turn him. His beautiful body is borne in the circling eddies. It is continually bruised on rocks. Swiftly, and aught out of sight is born the brave corpse. 4. I turn but do not extricate myself. Confused, a past reading, another, but with darkness yet. The beach is cut by the razory ice wind, the wreck guns sound. The tempest lulls, the moon comes floundering through the drifts. I look where the ship helplessly heads end on. I hear the burst as she strikes. I hear the howls of dismay. They grow fainter and fainter. I cannot aid with my wringing fingers. I can but rush to the surf and let it drench me and freeze upon me. I search with the crowd. Not one of the company is washed to us alive. In the morning, I help pick up the dead and lay them in rows in a barn. 5. Now of the older war days, the defeat at Brooklyn. Washington stands inside the lines. He stands on the entrenched hills amid a crowd of officers. His face is cold and damp. He cannot repress the weeping drops. He lifts the glass perpetually to his eyes. The color is blanched from his cheeks. He sees the slaughter of the Southern braves confided to him by their parents. The same at last, and at last, when peace is declared, he stands in the room of the old tavern. The well-beloved soldiers all pass through. The officers, speechless and slow, draw near in their turns. The chief encircles their necks with his arms and kisses them on the cheek. He kisses lightly the wet cheeks, one after another. He shakes hands and bids goodbye to the army. 6. Now, what my mother told me one day as we sat at dinner together, of when she was a nearly grown girl living home with her parents on the old homestead. A red squaw came one breakfast time to the old homestead. On her back, she carried a bundle of rushes for rush-bottoming chairs. Her hair, straight, shiny, coarse, black, profuse, half enveloped her face. Her step was free and elastic, and her voice sounded exquisitely as she spoke. My mother looked in delight and amazement at the stranger. She looked at the freshness of her tall, born face and full and pliant limbs. The more she looked upon her, she loved her. Never before had she seen such wonderful beauty and purity. She made her sit on a bench by the jamb of the fireplace. She cooked food for her. She had no work to give her, but she gave her remembrance and fondness. The red squaw stayed all the forenoon, and toward the middle of the afternoon she went away. Oh, my mother was loath to have her go away. All the week she thought of her. She watched for her many a month. She remembered her many a winter and many a summer. But the red squaw never came, nor was heard of there again. 7. A show of the summer softness, a contact of something unseen, an amour of the light and air. I am jealous and overwhelmed with friendliness, and will go gallivant with the light and air myself. Oh, love and summer, you are in the dreams and in me. Autumn and winter are in the dreams. The farmer goes with his thrift. The droves and crops increase. The barns are well filled. Elements merge in the night. Ships make tacks in the dreams. The sailor sails. The exile returns home. The fugitive returns unharmed. The immigrant is back beyond months and years. The poor Irishman lives in the simple house of his childhood with the well-known neighbors and faces. They warmly welcome him. He is barefoot again. He forgets he is well off. The Dutchman voyages home, and the Scotchman and the Welshman voyage home, and the native of the Mediterranean voyages home. To every port of England, France, Spain, enter well-filled ships. The Swiss foots it toward his hills. The Prussian goes his way. The Hungarian his way. And the Pole his way. The Swede returns. And the Dane and the Norwegian return. The homeward bound and the outward bound. The beautiful lost swimmer. The Inuit. The onanist. The female that loves unrequited. The moneymaker. The actor and actress. Those through with their parts, and those waiting to commence. The affectionate boy, the husband and wife, the voter, the nominee that is chosen, and the nominee that has failed. The great already known, and the great any time after today. The stammerer, the sick, the perfect formed, the homely. The criminal that stood in the box, the judge that sat and sentenced him, the fluent lawyers, the jury, the audience. The laugher and weeper, the dancer, the midnight widow, the red squaw, the consumptive, the recipolite, the idiot, he that is wronged, the antipodes, and everyone between this and them in the dark. I swear they are averaged now. One is no better than the other. The night and sleep have likened them and restored them. I swear they are all beautiful. Everyone that sleeps is beautiful. Everything in the dim light is beautiful. The wildest and bloodiest is over, and all is peace. Peace is always beautiful. The myth of heaven indicates peace and night. The myth of heaven indicates the soul. The soul is always beautiful. It appears more or it appears less. It comes or it lags behind. It comes from its embowered garden and looks pleasantly on itself and encloses the world. Perfect and clean the genitals previously jetting, and perfect and clean the womb cohering. The head well grown, proportioned and plumb. The bowels and joints proportioned and plumb. The soul is always beautiful. The universe is duly in order. Everything is in its place. What has arrived is in its place, and what waits shall be in its place. The twisted skull waits. The watery or rotten blood waits. The child of the glutton or the venereally waits long. And the child of the drunkard waits long. And the drunkard himself waits long. The sleepers that lived and died wait. The far advanced are to go on in their turns, and the far behind are to come on in their turns. The diverse shall be no less diverse, but they shall flow and unite. They unite now. 8. The sleepers are very beautiful as they lie unclothed. They flow hand in hand over the whole earth from east to west as they lie unclothed. The Asiatic and African are hand in hand. The European and American are hand in hand. Learned and unlearned are hand in hand. And male and female are hand in hand. The bare arm of the girl crosses the bare breast of her lover. They press close without lust. His lips press her neck. The father holds his grown or ungrown son in his arms with measureless love, and the son holds the father in his arms with measureless love. The white hair of the mother shines on the white wrist of the daughter. The breath of the boy goes with the breath of the man. Friend is enarmed by friend. The scholar kisses the teacher, and the teacher kisses the scholar, the wronged made right. The call of the slave is one with the master's call, and the master salutes the slave. The felon steps forth from the prison, the insane becomes sane, the suffering of sick persons is relieved. The sweatings and fevers stop, the throat that was unsound is sound, the lungs of the consumptive are resumed. The poor, distressed head is free. The joints of the rheumatic move as smoothly as ever, and smoother than ever. Stiflings and passages open. The paralyzed become supple. The swelled and convulsed and congested awake to themselves in condition. They pass the invigoration of the night and the chemistry of the night, and awake. I too pass from the night. I stay a while away, O night, but I return to you again and love you. Why should I be afraid to trust myself to you? I am not afraid. I have been well brought forward by you. I love the rich running day, but I do not desert her in whom I lay so long. I know not how I came of you, and I know not where I go with you. But I know I came well, and shall go well. I will stop only a time with the night, and rise betimes. I will duly pass the day, O my mother, and duly return to you. And now, let's turn to the critics section, the books department, in the July 1st, 2019 edition of The New Yorker, for an article entitled Looks Like Rain, How Weather Forecasting Got Good, by Hannah Fry. At 4:15 on the morning of June 4th, 1944, Group Captain James Martin Stagg, a meteorologist for the British military, arrived at the library of a grand manor house on the southern coast of England. On the other side of the room was General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied forces, the man Stagg had needed to convince that D-Day should be postponed. The conditions for the launch had to be just so: a full moon for visibility, low tides to expose the underwater German defenses. That left a narrow window of just 3 days in June, and June 5th was the date the generals had settled on. But the Allies' warships and aircraft would also need calm seas and clear skies, and here Stagg and his team had foreseen a problem. Even though the skies outside promised a bright morning, the meteorologist calculated that a parade of storms was poised to barrel across the Atlantic, hampering the prospects of success. The generals were wary of any delay, but Eisenhower reluctantly agreed to hold off. A few hours later, Stagg had better news. Allied weather stations were reporting a ridge of high pressure that would reach the beaches of Normandy on June 6th. The weather wouldn't be ideal, but it would be good enough to proceed. Eisenhower gave the order to reschedule the invasion. It's hard to overstate the importance of that weather forecast, as John Ross makes clear in a book on the subject. Had the Allies gone ahead as planned, the invasion probably would have failed. Had they postponed it until the next interval with favorable moon and tide conditions, they would have lost the elements of surprise. The German meteorologist had also foreseen the storms, but they missed the significance of the brief glimpse of calm. They were so confident that an Allied attack was impossible that Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, the commander of the Normandy defenses, decided to take a few days' leave for his wife's birthday. He'd even bought her a new pair of shoes in Paris for the occasion. Years later, when Eisenhower was asked why D-Day had been a success, he reportedly said, "Because we had better meteorologists than the Germans." In our world, weather forecasts are so ubiquitous that we treat them as notable only when wrong. It's easy to forget what a crucial role they play and to overlook the monumental achievement they represent. But Andrew Bloom's new book, The Weather Machine, published by Echo, asks us to pause and marvel at the globe-spanning networks of collaboration required to turn the weather from something we experience to something we can predict. It wasn't always possible to be so complacent. Wartime made the stakes of weather forecasting especially plain. Sometimes, as with D-Day, visibility was important. At other times, cloud cover and fog could help conceal a position. Alongside the battle for land, sea, and air, then, a quiet war over the atmosphere was being waged. The weather war even had its own clandestine undercover missions in search of mundane treasures like data on temperature, pressure, and wind speed. In the northern hemisphere, storms tend to move from west to east, so any prediction of what lay in store for Europe relied on knowing what was happening in the Atlantic. The Allies, who were in control of all the major land masses that lined the ocean, had the upper hand. The Nazis had to use long-range aircraft and secret weather ships to gather observations. The Allies tried to sink those ships, but the Nazis also made use of radio reports of canceled English soccer matches for hints about weather to the north. So, as Blum explains, in 1942, the German government came up with an ingenious solution. With help from the Siemens-Schuckertwerke Group, a predecessor of the modern-day Siemens, and others, it developed a series of automated weather stations. These were an intricate array of pressure, temperature, and humidity sensors encased in storm-resistant metal containers and equipped with batteries and a radio antenna. Some would hitch rides with the Luftwaffe and transmit weather readings from remote locations on the edge of Europe. By 1943, the devices were powerful enough to communicate across the Atlantic. That year, a Nazi submarine sneaked to the northernmost tip of Newfoundland, where a team of German soldiers took 10 canisters ashore on two rubber dinghies. For the plan to work, the weather station needed to stay undetected after it had been left in the wilderness. So they labeled the equipment Canadian Meteor Service and scattered the site with a host of American cigarette packs. Only in 1981 was the ruse discovered. The weather station itself was operational for a matter of months before the radio frequency jammed and the batteries died. But this mission marked one of the few known incursions of the Nazis on North American soil. Getting hold of weather data was important enough to take the risk. To anyone in Europe, the indispensability of that data hasn't diminished over time. But what in war was treated as a weapon to be mobilized against your enemy has become, in peace, the stuff of international cooperation for the common good. That's always been the way with weather. It has a strange ability both to unite and to divide. Blum tells a story about the early telegraph, which highlights this point. By 1848, more than 2,000 miles of telegraph lines had been laid across the United States. They were a technological marvel. But they were prone to problems when it rained. Every morning, telegraph operators checked with their colleagues in the surrounding cities to see what the weather was like. One operator was recorded as saying, "If I learned from Cincinnati that the wires to St. Louis were interrupted by rain, I was tolerably sure a northeast storm was approaching." The effect was to change people's perception of time and space. Being able to communicate through the telegraph might have made the world seem smaller, but those weather reports also made the world bigger, creating distance between places on a map. America was no longer a collection of small communities, but a coherent whole, spread out across a landscape, resting beneath a solitary sky. The weather changed from something that you experienced to a shared pattern stretching hundreds of miles, which you could see coming. Blum observes, once the news could travel faster than the winds need no longer come as a surprise. This connectivity could be ruptured when the telegraph network was interrupted during the Civil War. The flow of weather reports stopped and the towns and villages went back to not knowing what the skies might hold for the future. Modern weather forecasting, too, sits in the intersection of unity and division. The rockets and satellites launched during the Cold War helped provide a major breakthrough in weather prediction. The first images sent from the edge of space showed Earth wrapped in bands and whirls and vortices that stretched thousands of miles. It was a view of a world that belonged to all of us. As Blum's detailed, and sometimes overly so, chapters on satellites make clear, any snapshot of our atmosphere is something that unites the world, even while enabled by technology designed to destroy it. There's more to modern weather prediction, of course, than just extrapolating the path of a storm. It's not enough to mark on a map what the conditions are and have been. If you want to know what they'll be in the future, you need to understand what will change and why. You need a science of the atmosphere, which is no easy thing. Wilhelm Birknes was a Norwegian physicist who was born in 1862. He had spent much of his life toying with the forces in fluids when, at around the turn of the century, he began to wonder why the weather couldn't be tamed by science. If we can do it for the heavens, predicting planetary orbits and all that, why not for the skies? After all, air follows the same laws of physics as anything else, a bouncing ball, a falling apple, a planet orbiting a star. So he started with the fundamental laws. Matter cannot be created or destroyed, nor can energy. Momentum must be conserved. By tying those mathematical equations together for all the packets of air that make up our atmosphere and setting them on a spinning globe, Birknes thought that he'd found a way to sketch out how winds blew around our Earth. There was just one snag. Although the equations can be written in a few short lines, they are, beneath the surface, stupendously complicated. Interconnected aspects of the weather are nearly impossible to tease apart. Wind depends on temperature, temperature depends on pressure, and pressure depends on wind. It's an intricate mathematical tapestry that is far too intertwined to unpick by hand. To make matters worse, if you want to predict tomorrow's weather, you need to anchor those equations to the Earth as it is now, rather than to some idealized model of the globe that you'd find in a physics class. And that means you also have to account for a whole planet's worth of data. Temperature and pressure, worth of readings and wind speed metrics, from as many places as you can manage, along with various annoying fiddly things like water vapor and solar radiation, or the presence of valleys and mountains. It's enough to make rocket science look simple. Blum writes, "Landing a spacecraft on Mars requires dealing with hundreds of mathematical variables. Making a global atmospheric model requires hundreds of thousands." Birknes knew better than to try to solve his equations. Instead, he focused his efforts on collecting precise, numerous observations, pinpointing shifts in pressure and wind direction, and mapping the swirling weather fronts. And he wasn't wrong about the utility of data. It was these methods that would prove critical in the forecast for the Allied invasion of Normandy. But Birknes's key insight was that weather prediction could be framed as a hypothesis. He might not have been able to solve his equations, but in trying to tame tomorrow's weather, he'd come up with a useful kind of guess, one that could, at least in theory, be proved right or wrong when tomorrow came. And if the methods failed to capture what appeared in the sky, they could be fine-tuned in response. One day, he believed, meteorology could be a modern kind of science, verifiable and repeatable. After all, there's no shortage of tomorrows. "It takes many years to drill a tunnel through a mountain," he wrote. "Many workers will not live to see the breakthrough, but others will be able to travel through the tunnel at express speed." The big breakthrough toward conquering the equations came from the British mathematician Lewis Fry Richardson in the 1920s. He grasped that you didn't need a precise snapshot of all weather in all places. All anyone wanted was an answer that was good enough, drawing on a rough sketch of planetary conditions. His idea was to split the globe up into a grid, like a chessboard, with each square representing a gigantic column of air, a column as high as the atmosphere and as wide as a couple of hundred kilometers. He envisaged an army of human computers, pencil and paper in hand, dispatched to each square, calculating approximate answers for the equations in their section, and regularly swapping numbers with people in the neighboring squares, so that the mathematical winds could blow from one corner of Earth to another. Richardson's vision would wrestle the equations into submission, but it was rather ahead of its time. Working the calculations for just two single chess squares by hand, it took him 6 weeks to calculate a forecast 6 hours ahead. Not ideal for a prediction that would be of any use. As Richardson explained in a 1922 treatise, he realized that he would need a staff of 64,000 human computers if he was to have any hope of keeping up with the weather. And that was assuming they could each work some 10 times faster than he'd managed to do on his first go. But that didn't stop him from dreaming of the possibility of what he described as, quote, a central forecast factory for the whole globe, end quote. He imagined it as a vast dome-shaped stadium with walls painted to form a map of the world. England is in the gallery, the tropics in the upper circle, Australia on the dress circle, and the Antarctic in the pit, he wrote. The North Pole would be up at the ceiling. Thousands of calculators would be seated around a high pulpit from which something akin to a conductor would orchestrate the proceedings, making sure that the calculators were working at speed. Quote, he turns a beam of rosy light upon any region running ahead of the rest, and a beam of blue light upon those who are behindhand, end quote. Sadly, Richardson's forecast factory never came to pass. But 28 years later, in 1950, the first modern electrical computer, the ENIAC, made use of his methods and generated a weather forecast. The Richardsonian method proved to be remarkably accurate. The only downside? The 24-hour forecast took about 24 hours to produce. The math, even when aided by an electronic brain, could only just keep pace with the weather. It was a long time before we could build machines that were capable of scrolling ahead to the future faster than time can progress. Blum, in his book, recounts the visit to the ECMWF, the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecast, where a 10-day forecast can now be completed in 2.25 hours. There, Richardson's forecast factories have become real-life cathedrals of calculation, with supercomputers housed in rooms the size of volleyball courts. At weather prediction centers around the world, Birkness's equations have been tweaked and Richardson's methods refined. The chess squares can now be as small as a couple of kilometers across. But the fundamental ideas are essentially the same. Blum describes the process of prediction as though there were two parallel worlds running in sequence. The real one, our own blue marble, and the simulated one, which lives inside the machine. Model Earth adjusts itself to match real Earth, to take into account all the observations fed in by flying satellites, buoys, and balloons, and then it races ahead and fast forward. Periodically, it pauses for real Earth to catch up, checks its answers, corrects anything it got wrong, makes adjustments, and then gallops off into the future again. The supercomputers have brought improved accuracy, too. In 2015, the ECMWF's 6-day forecast was as good as its 3-day forecast was in 1975. In 2012, its computers correctly foresaw Hurricane Sandy at least 6 days in advance. By 2025, they are expected to be able to detect high-impact events 2 weeks into the future. The ECMWF's American cousin, run by the National Weather Service, tends to be a little less accurate a little more often. Notably, it had Hurricane Sandy turning out to sea until just 4 days before it made landfall. The two systems differ in the way they take observations into account, and there is no shortage of people who are vehement proponents of one model over the other. But both, of course, have their shortcomings. Anyone who has ever been caught short without an umbrella won't need to be told that even an accurate prediction isn't the same as a perfect one. Richardson's method, or any method devised since, still can't solve the equations exactly, only approximate them. And the distance between the model world and the real world, the discrepancy between what we can predict and what will happen, widens as we spin forward further into the future. That puts a limit on how good weather forecast will ever be. It's the butterfly flapping its wings in New Mexico and causing a hurricane in China. The atmosphere is too complicated, too fragile, too sensitive to small perturbations to submit to the equations with the precision of planets or stars. All this is compounded by the fact that the big forecasting models typically stick to general patterns of pressure, airspeed, precipitation, and temperature. They don't yield sensible answers like, it will rain on Wednesday in Soho, or hailstorms will start at 2 p.m. That's where the various apps and weather services like Dark Sky, Weather.com, and Yahoo Weather come in. They pull together the results from the various global models, occasionally add their own data, and often spit out a much more local, tangible prediction. The apps differ wildly in how they handle all that uncertainty, and some will be much more pessimistic than others. The BBC app, for instance, will display the rain icon even if there is less than a 50% chance of precipitation. While one study showed that, when a particular Kansas City local news channel predicted certain rain, it didn't rain at all about 30% of the time. There's plenty of fuzziness in turning probabilities into predictions. Blum recalls a conversation with Tim Palmer, an Oxford professor and a key figure at the ECMWF. Palmer said, somebody phoned up and it was their wedding anniversary or something and they were having a big party. They had to know by Monday if they should get this marquee on Sunday. Was it going to rain or not? The problem, Palmer pointed out, is that life isn't so simple. How important is it that the people who are coming to your party don't get wet? If it's the Queen and there was a 10% chance of rain, investing in the marquee would make good sense. But Palmer went on, if it was just your mates from the pub, you might not bother getting a marquee unless it was about 80% probability. No weather forecaster can tell you for sure when to wear a rain slicker, stock up on canned goods, or evacuate a city that's in a cyclone's path. All forecasters can offer is their best guess at the atmosphere of the future, whispered by the simulated blue marble and wrapped up in uncertainty. There will always be a gap between the weather and the forecast. Unfortunately, that gap becomes critical in the case of extreme weather events. It's not just during wartime that the forecast can be a matter of life and death. As our planet warms, we are going to see more hurricanes, more crippling droughts, and more devastating rainstorms than ever before. Even if we manage to achieve the goal set by the Paris Agreement and global warming is kept to under 2 degrees centigrade, the impact on our weather will be dramatic. 2 degrees might not sound like much. It can be the difference between a nice day and a slightly nicer day. But that shift in temperature makes extremes more likely. Our long-range predictions, especially those which anticipate extreme weather events, rely on an assumption that the future will be similar to the past. Lose that, and we lose the tools that have allowed us to prepare for such eventualities. It's easy to forget that behind each prediction is one of humankind's greatest accomplishments, something that requires armies of people all over the globe collecting and sharing data, exquisite mathematical modeling, and staggering computer power. The weather doesn't respect political or geographic boundaries. We're all living under the same sky. And so, weather prediction has been a marvel not only of technology, but also of international cooperation. as we enter an era of more storms and greater uncertainty than we've ever experienced. Let's hope it stays that way. And now we'll turn to some short essays in the Talk of the Town section. First, in the Pictures Department, What If? By Michael Schulman. Elevator pitch. What if you woke up tomorrow morning and were the only person on earth who remembered the Beatles? John, Paul, George, Ringo, forgotten. Marmalade Skies, gibberish. You scribble down all the lyrics you remember, pass off the songs as your own, and get a huge record deal. Everyone thinks you're a rock god. You know you're a phony. This scenario is the premise of Yesterday, the new film from Danny Boyle, a sort of reverse biopic in which the subjects are erased from history, leaving a yellow submarine-sized hole. To play Jack Malik, the struggling singer-songwriter who goes from anonymity to Malik mania, Boyle casts the British actor Himesh Patel. Yesterday is his first film. Hours before its premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival, Patel, who is 28, stepped out of a hired car on a rainy West Village street. Tourists have multiple New York Beatles tours to choose from. But Patel had opted for his own customized What If the Beatles Never Existed tour. Before him was 105 Bank Street, a cracked white stucco townhouse where an obscure couple named John and Yoko lived between 1971 and 1973. I looked this building up, Patel, rumpled black hair, green raincoat said. There was some family living there in the late 19th century with three brothers. Two of them tried to scam the other's widow out of some money, and they ended up in court. So there's this whole weird backstory of sibling criminality. He shrugged and got back in the car. He self-taped his audition for Yesterday in 2017, he recalled, when he was in New York doing an off-Broadway play. All the posting said was Danny Boyle Project, working title, musical elements. I had to do a monologue from a play and a Coldplay song of my choice. He chose We Never Change. Days later, he was summoned to London. Before he left, he spotted a busker on a subway platform singing, I Want to Hold Your Hand. As I passed, he winked at me, Patel recalled. That was a weird sign. The car dropped him off at the Dakota on the Upper West Side, known for its role in Rosemary's Baby. A French tour group passed by. Patel could make out the guide saying, Jean and Lennon. Mysterious. He walked into Central Park, where people were leaving roses on a mosaic, and a guitarist on a park bench was singing a Jack Malik hit, Imagine. Patel was reminded of the first scene he shot for Yesterday, in which Jack plays his own songs on the streets of Clacton-on-Sea. One passerby, not in the cast, turned to Patel's music coach and said, Quite good, isn't he? The French tourists arrived. Time to go. Patel was raised in a small town in Cambridgeshire, where his parents, Indian Hindus, who immigrated from Africa, ran a newspaper shop. We were the only South Asian family for miles, Patel said. He grew up on Bollywood, but when he tried to interest his classmates in Indian music, they brushed him off. I wasn't really listened to it this time, he said, but it turns out Indian music was such a bedrock of what we know as pop because the Beatles were doing it. Eventually, he got into indie rock, The Killers, The Arctic Monkeys. At 16, he was cast on the British soap opera EastEnders as Tamwar Masood, the nerdy son of a Pakistani family, and stayed for 8 years. The car reached the Ed Sullivan Theater, where nothing particularly scream-worthy happened on February 9, 1964. Patel had brought his father there 2 years ago to see a taping of The Late Show. Weirdly, tomorrow, me, Danny, and Richard Curtis are going to Stephen Colbert's house for dinner, Patel said, chuffed. The car drove past the Warwick Hotel, where a loopy press conference did not occur on August 22, 1966. Reporter Do you think that happiness is really egg-shaped, or is it just a rumor from the egg marketing magazine? Paul, hoo, 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 hoo. The last stop was Shea Stadium in Flushing, where 55,000 fans did not gather on August 15, 1965. What's harder than making a band disappear? Making a stadium disappear. They paved paradise, Patel said, approaching the parking lot where Shea used to be. The new stadium next door, Citi Field, was hosting New York Beer Fest. A guard pointed Patel to Lot D, where a plaque that read, Site of Shea Stadium Home Plate, 1964 to 2008. I feel like I'm in Jack's World, Patel said. Where did it go? He was reminded of a scene they shot in Liverpool at Strawberry Field, a children's home that inspired no songs whatsoever. When the crew got there, it was rubble. It felt like some eerie representation of the story. We destroyed them. Turns out the place was just being renovated. The vicar at the church told us that, Patel said. And now, also from the Talk of the Town section, an essay by Ariel Levy. I miss seeing you on television, an elderly woman named Renee squawked at her neighbor, the actress, comedian, and singer Sandra Bernhard. They were in front of the stately brick Frederick Fleming House on West 22nd Street, a residence for formerly homeless New Yorkers where Renee has lived for 16 years. But honey, you see me all the time, Bernard replied. She walks her dog, George, along the block daily. Renee, who has no teeth and a quantity of chin hair, eyed Bernard up and down and told her, You look different on television. Bernard is starring in the second season of Pose, the Ryan Murphy drama about the gritty, glamorous world of transgender women and gay men who staged New York's legendary drag balls. She plays an activist nurse at Roosevelt Hospital during the height of the AIDS crisis. We'll put your show on the schedule, Martha Benikos, Fleming's House's manager, who was passing by, promised. Well, thank you, sweetheart, Bernard said. This place keeps the neighborhood grounded in old New York, like there's still a place where people can live and not be pushed out by $20 million apartments. Season 2 of Pose is set in 1990, when there were still hookers on the piers, and Madonna's Vogue video introduced the culture of ballrooms to viewers of MTV's. It was a time when Bernard and Madonna were tight. They were often photographed out together like a kind of two-headed it girl. It was really fun. We could go to parties, and we could be really crass. We were crass to Joan Rivers, Bernard said. I had a little crush on her, and I loved that people were like, ooh, Madonna likes Sandy. Bernard has been with her partner Sarah Switzer for 20 years, but she doesn't use the word lesbian to describe herself. How about sophisticated? How about groovy, sexual, international, hot, swinging? Those are all words that work for me, she said and laughed. She played one of the first queer characters on television, on Roseanne. People used to attack me for not coming out and saying, I'm a dyke, she said. All these tastemasters in the gay world were handing me my ass, and I thought, you don't even get it. I was in the trenches in the 70s breaking all the rules about what sexuality was. Even when I was 16 in Scottsdale, the most conservative place on earth. Bernhard's father, a proctologist, and her mother, an abstract artist, moved Bernhard and her three brothers to Arizona from Flint, Michigan, when she was 10 years old. As smart as I am, I didn't really apply myself in school because all I could think about was leaving and becoming this fabulous, international, sophisticated person, she said. From the time she was a child and saw Carol Channing in Hello, Dolly, she knew that she wanted to be a performer. After high school, she went to Israel and worked on a kibbutz for 9 months, and then moved to Los Angeles. She supported herself by working as a manicurist. For 5 years, she clipped cuticles and entertained her clients, who included Victoria Principal, always in a jaunty hat, and Diane Cannon. I became part of whatever was happening at the time, going to Studio One, which was like Studio 54 in L.A., but with all gay men. I was the only woman in there. Like Bette Midler, one of Bernhardt's early idols who got her start performing in New York's bathhouses, Bernhardt was embraced by the drag demi-monde. She could relate to drag. Creating a persona was as much a part of her art as singing or stand-up was. I used to be being brash and over the top and fun and making declarations and proclamations, she said. Bernhardt's edge, her rolling mix of passion, rage, and wit, is what led Martin Scorsese to cast her as Jerry Lewis's stalker in The King of Comedy, her breakout role in 1981. Just getting the role, I had arrived, she said. Deborah Winger was up for it. And I think Meryl Streep. Nobody else could have done it. He was looking for the person I was to make the role work. Now, the 64-year-old mother of a college student, Bernhardt, who was dressed in a style she called nautical but nice, in a striped jersey and jeans, had a disarmingly gentle vibe in person. I've gotten less shady, she said. People still want me to be cranky, but I don't enjoy it anymore. Renee produced a crumpled piece of paper from her pocket and asked for an autograph. To the coolest lady on West 22nd Street, Bernhardt wrote. Well, that's all the time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.